Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone, of the Department of History at Augustana College. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. In Cleo's mansion, there are many rooms. In this, another of our occasional forays into the sub-disciplines of history, we enter a freshly painted door with a shiny plaque labeled World History. Inside, the decor is mostly modern. It is crowded, and the occupants are engaged in noisy and often vociferous conversation. Here to guide us through this room is Peter N. Stearns. He is professor of history at George Mason University, where from 2000 to 2014, he was also that university's provost. Prior to that, he served at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, where, among other things, he taught his first course in world history. A social historian by training, he has over the course of his career authored or edited over 100 books and founded and edited the Journal of Social History in 1967. Do you still edit that journal, sir?
Yeah, I'm actually on my last week. I'm turning it over as of the 1st of August. But
well, that was a pretty good run.
That's correct.
That's right. So let's begin a little autobiographically. You, as I said, began as a social historian.
Right.
But how did you come to teach your first? You founded Journal of Social History in 67. What was the year you taught your first course in world history?
Oh, in world history, I think that's I'm not totally precise, but it was in the early 80s. I think 1982. Okay, so well after my career had begun.
Sure. So you would come to world history, and later. What led you to teach that first course?
Okay. Well, I was trained as a European historian. My first job was teaching Western Civ at the University of Chicago, which has a well-established and highly reputed Western Civilization course. And I was perfectly happy with Western Civ for a long time, had it myself when I was in college. But I did become increasingly aware that I just plain didn't know enough about other parts of the world. So that was a personal dissatisfaction. And then I had an encounter in the early 80s, very early 80s, with a high school teacher from Yonkers, New York. We were at a college board conversation about what students should know in history when they got out of high school. And I assumed we would agree they should know some Western Civ. And she said, no, we live in a world. They should know something about the world. And I was immediately persuaded. Again, already sort of uncomfortable with my own lack of knowledge outside of the Western orbit. So I decided that I should learn something about world history. And in the context of where I was teaching at that point at Carnegie Mellon, it was actually appropriate to introduce a pilot world history course, which I did, as I say, I think in 82, and then we made it part of the Gen Ed program a couple years later.
Well, so how would you define world history? Let's begin with first principles.
The world history is obviously an attempt to help students understand some of the main patterns of change and development that the human species has encountered on a global basis. So we're looking at the big deal changes in the human experience, but not confined to any single region. Another way to put it is when people try to define what students should know as part of being global citizens, they normally emphasize, I think, two things. One, they should have some awareness, and this is part of Augustana's habits of mind list, they should have some awareness of the existence of different cultural and institutional traditions and some sensitivity to how those differences compare and operate. And they should also have some idea of the processes that unite different societies in different parts of the world, the global processes that have emerged over time. So another way of putting it is world history tries to give students the basis for those two qualities of global citizenship, awareness of alternative traditions and awareness of global connections.
How long do you think, you probably know, how long has the term world history been in use?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not absolutely sure. There was a flurry of work in the 60s associated with William McNeill at the University of Chicago, whose book Rise of the West drew wide notice, and also an historian at Northwestern, Lefton Stavrianos. They both used the term world history in the 60s, and it was really from their efforts that you began to get a tiny thread of interest in world history. But de facto, world history has existed for a long time. Many of the great figures in history, from Herodotus onward, tried to write about the whole world as they knew it. They didn't use the word, but it's not a brand new concept.
Right. Herodotus is trying to explain the Persian Wars and in Greece, and to do that, he feels he has to explain the wider world around Greece, how these Persians came to concern themselves with Greece.
That is correct. And he's just widely interested. He didn't.
Yeah.
He accepted a lot of nonsense about other societies, but he's widely interested in as many societies as he can get his hands on.
You, in your really outstanding little book, World History, The Basics, you start with Herodotus, and you point out that in a way, world history was in the genes of the historical study at the beginning, but for a variety of reasons in the 19th century, it became sidetracked.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean everybody wrote world history, but a lot of the great minds, not only Herodotus, but Ibn Khaldun in North Africa, many of the Enlightenment historians, they didn't know as much about the rest of the world as we probably think they should have, but they had a global view. And that then got shot at in the 19th century with the twin developments of an emphasis on very detailed empirical history of the sort that the German historians were famous for, but even more with the rise of the service of history to the nation state. So increasingly historians began to look at smaller chunks of the past, and they particularly began to look at history divided by nation state.
Mm-hmm. Romantic nationalism focuses historians upon their nation. So von Ranke is creating the scientific history, but he's also studying, you know, how did Germany come to be?
Right. And history teachers in the United States were increasingly teaching about U.S. history, not to the total neglect of the rest of the world, but substantial neglect. And so it went, and we're still saddled with that as a teaching framework in many countries today.
Mm-hmm. So, William, in the 20th century, I was struck by how the Cold War, in many ways, began world history. I know William McNeill, his early seminars were often given to Defense Department audiences on the rise of the West and trying to explain that. And, of course, in the Marxist side of the world, in many ways, I think, reading between the lines, much of the interest in world history there was framed by an anti-nationalism, trying to find how the revolution was going to work across cultures and across nations.
I think that's absolutely right. Exactly. Yeah.
So we can say that along with microwave ovens, world history was energized by the Cold War. I don't think that's too far.
Beginning to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the Cold War, in the American context particularly, the Cold War called our attention increasingly to the fact that the United States was a powerful player, but no longer described mainly in terms of its relationships with Western Europe. I mean, Western Civ made a lot of sense for the United States when we were mainly looking to Europe as our international partner or competitor. But with the Cold War, we increasingly realized that we were engaged with the whole world, and we needed a different kind of history in order to help us prepare for that.
So, yeah, on the crudest level, we were beginning to ask just who are these people?
Yep.
And how did they come to be?
Exactly.
Let's march through some aspects of your book on world history. You're excellent, as I said, this fantastic little primer that comes from published by Routledge, which is a part of their series, a wider series called The Basics.
Right.
You, to say one of the first things, and this is, I think, true for all history, but must especially be true for world history, is what to omit. What
exactly
to leave
so.
out? Why do you? What do you mean by that?
Well, look, I mean, this was the first lecture I ever heard in world history by this guy, Stavrianos, and his first statement, it was right up there on the chalkboard, dare to omit. I mean, world history potentially could encompass so much stuff that it would become quickly unmanageable, and indeed, many world history textbooks, including some that I've participated in, are even now too big. You've just got to figure out how to hit the highlights. What are some of the essentials? We're not going to agree on all the essentials, but historians have trouble with this. Historians like to put as much in as they can possibly find, and world history just can't work that way. You have to be selective. You have to understand the things are being left out.
It's ruined a lot of dissertations, and a lot of graduate students' lives, the inability to admit, omit. And
that is correct. It can spoil history presentations for non-historian audiences. If we don't know the highlights, how are they expected to know them?
Right. So we have to have an argument. We have to have something, a skeleton to hang world history upon.
Right.
What are you discuss at least three concepts in this section about what to omit? And one of them is time periods and basic themes.
Right.
And how does that work?
Well, look, I mean, there's considerable agreement among world historians, not complete agreement, that you can chunk world history into a surprisingly small number of basic time slots. Again, you can complicate each time slot as much as you have space and patience for, but the main chunks are defined by big changes in system like the rise of agriculture or then later the rise of industry, by big changes in the nature of contacts among societies, most obviously, for example, when you get to around 1500 and the Americas begin to be included in world interactions for the first time regularly. So you can chunk time into some basic periods where the themes are reasonably coherent. They're not magically suitable for every society equally, but they really work in terms of calling attention to the high points.
So what would be some of those chunks?
Well, again, the rise of agriculture, the emergence
About what date?
Well, the first is around 9000 BCE, and in the agriculture develops at different times in different places, but you begin the agricultural story around 11,000 years ago. The next big chunk, usually after that, is the rise of more complex societies within the agricultural orbit, what some people call the rise of civilizations, where you have formal states, more elaborate cities, more elaborate trade relationships, in almost every case, the introduction of writing. Then you have an early civilization period that will extend to 800 or 600 BCE. Then usually you shift gears again and talk about the formation of some great traditions in key classical civilizations, China, India, Persia, the Mediterranean.
For example?
Those are the main ones.
This is the so-called axial age of religions too, then, right?
It's sometimes called the axial. I think that term has faded a little bit, but yes, that's the period that's being covered. That is correct.
We've got I think roughly in a very very broad way, we've got what would it be? We've got Homer, we've got Confucius, Buddha, and Ezra among in the Jews.
Zoroaster among the Persians. So yes, a number of basic intellectual figures. Yes,
and an age of incredible richness then going on throughout the world in terms
again,
of religions.
Yeah, again, it doesn't cover the whole world. I mean, that's a limitation. But in those societies, you get key traditions founded, elements of which in most cases are still visible today.
Right. And then next period.
Okay, well then the classical societies either fall apart or at least change significantly. So you have a subsequent period opening up around 500 or 600 CE, which I call post-classical. There's no great name for it, but
Right.
it is defined particularly by two key developments, and that is the expansion, or in the case of Islam, the development of major missionary religions. So religions become more important, and much of the religious map of the world is set in these centuries. And at the same time, you have increasing trade relationships among different parts of Africa, Asia, and Europe. Sometimes this goes hand in hand with missionary religions. Sometimes there's a bit of tension. But those key developments set the framework for this next period.
And we then are in what we call the modern period, I guess, for.
Well, you then, I mean, the standard is, I think you could cut this in slightly different ways, but the conventional way is to say the next period is the early modern period, from the 15th century till the middle of the 18th century, defined by, again, heightened trade relationships, the inclusion of the Americas, the formation of new kinds of empire, both the colonial empires, but also land-based empires in Russia and many parts of Asia. So that's the early modern slice. And then that is usually seen as blending into what sometimes gets called the long 19th century, which is shaped by the emergence of industrialization, but also Western dominance of industrialization. So this is the great age of imperialism. And that runs until the early 20th century, where you begin to see the contours of what we would call the contemporary period of world history, the past century, shaped by rebalancing among major powers, the industrialization of new areas, a number of patterns of political and social change.
You discuss of a great chapter on habits of mind that come from historical thinking, and given the name of this podcast, this is something that we certainly have to touch upon. You suggest that among the historical habits of mind, there are those such as handling source materials, using historical data to test propositions about human behavior, and also the consciousness of change over time.
Right. And I would add the fourth one, the comparative skill.
Sure. Compare and but I was curious, you then suggest that world history in particular has certain additional habits of mind, and you do emphasize the comparison of different societies.
Yeah, the two habits of mind that I think are peculiar to world history are, again, the absolute necessity of being able to compare, to identify similarities, sometimes beneath the surface, as well as to highlight differences. So that's one. And then the other one, which is easy to say but really hard to pin down, is the capacity to interrelate local and global factors, to see society shaped by a combination of things that are fairly local or regional, but also contacts and other influences from a much wider geographical area. So the local global habit is one that I think we need to define and work on a little bit more clearly than we've managed to date.
Could you expand on that a little bit? I'm a little unclear
Well,
on.
okay. I mean, take today. I mean, today is easy, but when you look at the economy of the United States, you may point to particular developments that are the fruit of federal policy or developments on Wall Street, but were also profoundly shaped by Chinese manufacture and trade patterns, by international rules and regulations associated with institutions like the International Monetary Fund. So our economy is a local global combination, and the same things would hold true for many other societies, for cultural as well as economic developments. It's that mixture, sometimes that tension, that I think, I mean, it's particularly obvious in the contemporary world, but you can begin to pick it up at least in the post-classical period, where you have new interactions combining with more local forces.
Let's try that out then. Right off the top of our heads, no books in front of us. If we played a local, global interaction, say in, I don't know, 19th or let's say early 18th century, Europe, we've got the rise of the English banking system. We've got the rise of state, basically the state debt, the Bank of England, this sort of new financial mechanism. How does this relate then to that's local? How can we relate that
and
to the
you
global?
You have other developments that are mainly regional, for example, the scientific revolution.
Yes.
But all of this takes place in a context in which Europe is also being shaped by using new foods, which they'd acquired from the New World, such as the potato, which will begin to spur massive population growth. It's shaped by the experience of growing participation in world trade, which brings new goods, new prosperity to some Europeans. It's shaped, and this has some impact on the scientific revolution, it's shaped by some knowledge of natural phenomena in other parts of the world. So it's a local global combination, and I think the example works quite well.
Mm-hmm. You discuss in two chapters managing time and managing space. Just explain what you mean first by managing time.
Well, the time part we've to some extent talked about already, right? With the discussion of periodization. I mean, if world history was just one century after another, it would A, become really boring, and B, again, become too detailed to manage. So we manage time as any historian does by trying to say that there are ways to chunk larger periods in terms of basic themes. The managing space is tricky. It's basically a statement that you need to make some decisions, first of all, about what parts of the world you're going to emphasize particularly, though you don't want to leave any major area out entirely. But above all, how are you going to define key parts of the world in terms of some degree of regional coherence? Let me use an easy example. When Islam rose after 600 and quickly spread through most of the Middle East and North Africa, it created a coherent region, Middle East, North Africa, which is still a coherent region today. It doesn't mean that every place in that region is exactly the same, but there is a coherence based particularly on the predominance of Arabs, not the monopoly of Arabs, but predominance of Arabs, and above all, the predominance of Islam. So that's a coherent region. Other regions are sometimes a little more difficult to define. You have options. Should Japan be regarded as a separate society, or is it part of a broader East Asian society? But you've got to make decisions about how you're going to define regional coherence and how many regions you're going to be able to tackle.
And of course, this greatly affects one's analysis and ability to make draw these conclusions about human behavior.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, these are not God-given decisions. There's always room for debate, and it depends, frankly, on how much time and detail one can manage. You may want to start world history with a fairly small number of basic regions, and then if you got more advanced in it, you could deal with some more complicated differentiations.
Now, world history is often relied upon various contacts between various cultures.
Yes.
We mentioned Herodotus was basically speaking of the contact, the violent contact and the peaceful contact between the Greeks and the Persians. As I recall, MacNeil's Rise of the West is focused around Eurasia and the contacts across Eurasia. What are the promises and the perils of focusing on contacts?
Well, I mean, the promise is it's a particularly interesting kind of human experience. I mean, if you assume that at some point key regions had some degree of self-definition, that is, they had some degree of identifiable intellectual and institutional traditions, when they come into serious contact with each other as a result of migration, invasion, trade, missionary activity, whatever, there are going to be some really interesting adjustments result. And Each major chronological phase of world history sees more elaborate sets of contacts. So each major phase of world history sees a new set of questions for any given society about how much adjustment they have to make to the other societies that they are encountering. Do they insist on their separate identity and try to pull back? Do they embrace other influences? What's the mixture? It's one of the key questions today, and it's a question that you can extend back in time easily 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are there any problems with emphasizing contact in world history?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is contacts are important, but they don't describe the whole experience, particularly in some of the earlier phases of world history. So you also need attention to the separate regional development of societies, particularly up until about 1000 CE. After about 1000 CE, contacts and innovations and tensions that develop around contacts carry the story much more successfully.
It seems to me sometimes that the one of the important stories in world history is the lack of contact, as we've seen the lack of contact between, say, Australia and the rest of the world for God knows how long.
Sure.
I forget or between.
Right. Depends on the region. I mean, some societies, Australia is a case in point. The Americas are cases in point before 1492. Some societies just have to be understood as having a somewhat later interaction with other societies than some of the key societies in Africa, Asia, and Europe did. And that's one of the complexities of the overall story.
This is we'll put this book on the reading list, but Alfred Crosby's Ecological Imperialism is in many ways a study of the ecological implications of that isolation and what happened after first contact.
Absolutely.
The disputes in world history, I should say, controversies, arguments, which, by the way, is not a pejorative term. We're not using that pejoratively, not necessarily. Arguments are a good thing. Hopefully, they will lead to some greater level of understanding. What are the arguments in world history that are shared with the rest of historical studies?
Well, I mean, there are certainly arguments about, I mean, we've touched on some of this. You can have productive arguments about how you define the regions you're going to use. I don't think there are huge arguments about periodization, but there's certainly some nuances around the edges that can be productively debated. I think some of the more interesting arguments in world history have developed around comparative findings, another theme we've touched on already. To use an example that I think is absolutely riveting, world history has changed the way we explain, or at least approach the need to explain, the emergence of Western industrialization, what some historians call the Great Divergence, when Western society began to differ from other societies. That used to be explained in terms of internal Western dynamics alone. But it turns out that other societies, most obviously China, were very close to the West in terms of levels of development. So you get a new set of debates. Why did the West, in fact, industrialize first? What differentiated the West from China in what was actually a fairly close match? You can have similar debates around dynamism of the Islamic religion in the post-classical period. What constituted its great strengths compared to some of the other missionary religions with which it was in competition? So I think a number of comparative debates are generated by the world history approach.
You mentioned finally three big debates in our last 10 minutes or so. Let's focus on them one at a time and maybe see if we can maybe add some more possibilities to that. The first was the big debate in world history over world economy.
Yeah, well, there is a schema that was promoted by Emanuel Wallerstein that that I find very useful that talks about the emergence of unequal regional economic relations in the early modern period. It's a schema that explains a lot, including some persistent inequalities that we're still grappling with today.
What is the schema, briefly?
Okay, so some societies, particularly initially the West, became very successful because they traded in processed goods and they controlled the trading companies that did the work. Other societies producing for the same world economy contributed cheaper raw materials and foods, and there was an inherent and growing imbalance in this trading relationship where the rich got richer and the poor tended to get poorer. It was very hard to get out of this relationship. Again, traces of it remain today. But it's a schema that also has some flaws. In other words, this is why it's up for debate. It doesn't cover aspects of Asian patterns very well. It doesn't allow for cultural factors very well. And by the time you get to the 20th century, it may not adequately explain how many societies like China and India begin to get out of the trap and manage to increasingly approach Western levels, Western economic levels on their own terms. So there's lots of richness in this theory, but there are lots of reasons to debate it as well.
Modernization, the debate over modernization stems back to Max Weber.
This is a good one. Modernization officially is something that historians say they don't like anymore, but many people, whether historians or not, continue to think in modernization terms. That is, they think that over the past century, any society that's worth its salt should be trying to industrialize, trying to develop a more modern political system, et cetera, et cetera. So is this a pattern that makes any sense, or is it too bound up in Western assumptions? There's some good debate here, even though officially most historians will, in political correct terms, say that they don't like modernization anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we say that, but we always it always creeps into the analysis, I've noticed.
Absolutely.
I guess I would tie into that secularization as well.
Sure, which is of course a really tough one, because if you look at world history over the past 50 years, it's not at all clear that secularization is predominating. So yes, that can be attached to the modernization debate as well.
Yeah, and then globalization.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's several types of debates here. The easy one is when globalization effectively began. Many social scientists and some historians argue that globalization is very new. My guess is that most world historians would like to say, well, yeah, maybe, but there are key aspects of it that emerge earlier. So one debate is simply over when the phenomenon effectively begins. I think the richer debates ultimately are in what kinds of trade-offs globalization forces between regional identities and more global themes, what kinds of developments globalization spurs that we would largely see as, quote, good, and what kinds of developments may be seen in terms of a certain degree of human loss.
And I guess also how we even define globalization, too.
Yes, again, you get back there into the local global trade. No globalization theorist, at least no historian, argues that globalization absolutely overrides all local characteristics. It's the combination that's operative, and that's probably what would then focus the debate.
What do you see as some of the interesting new approaches in world history? One thing I should say, you mentioned this, that there's some people refer to the new global history. What is that, and how is that different from
the new
world
global history?
History
is one that's going to focus on globalization, and particularly is going to tend to argue that globalization is a very recent phenomenon. So global history is fairly new. World history is a backdrop. I don't think this is a dominant theme. I think most historians are going to be less focused on the contemporary alone, but that is one option. Environmental history, obviously, is a huge and growing field in world history, quite appropriately. So that's another area that I think is gaining ground. Another theme that organizes an interesting set of debates is the tension between more conventional approaches to world history, which I suppose I am part of, versus the new argument for big history. Yeah, that would begin history well before the emergence of the human species, and try to look at the whole history of the planet and the solar system as the framework for the human experience. That's caught a lot of attention, among other things, apparently the attention of Bill Gates, which is always nice. But again, there are questions as to does big history take us away from some of the important aspects of the human experience? What's actually a manageable approach when you're talking about teaching high school students or college freshmen? So there's some practical issues as well as issues of principle here.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious. I'm going to have someone on, one of the big practitioners of big history.
Sounds good.
In a couple of weeks. I am curious whether I still am. Geez, I feel like such a fuddy-duddy, but I don't. I'm not sure I can call it history necessarily. I like to have my people involved in my history.
Well, again, let somebody make the case. I have every respect for big history. I certainly think that the environmental context of the human experience needs more attention than most of us used to give it. My biggest concern is manageability. If big history is going to include adequate attention to the human experience, can we do that in a way that's manageable in a survey course, and at the same time get it some of the big history dimensions?
In other words, we're back to the old problem of coverage.
Sure. Coverage, and again, not just coverage. I want to pick up one of your own points here. You want not just manageable coverage. You want a sensible balance between developing habits of mind and learning stuff. So you want a history course that really encourages students to think about how they handle the phenomenon of change, how they handle issues of evidence, how they handle comparisons. And if you try to pump too much other stuff into the course, you're not going to have enough time to expand on those skills.
So just in our last few minutes, Peter Stearns, if you were talking to an associate professor who just been tenured, who feels free at last and is interested in giving this world history thing a try, even though she did her work in 17th century gender history in England, where would you suggest that she begin? Where should she start as she reads her way into a new kind of course?
Right. Well, let's see. The first thing to say is that I would applaud such ambition. I think many historians, and this is another argument in the field, as you know, quite apart from world history, many historians have become unduly specialized, and that ultimately isn't as interesting as it should be to us or to our students. So I would applaud the ambition. The second thing to say is doing world history requires a bit of a conversion experience. You need to be willing to loosen up on some established assumptions. You need to be willing to talk about societies that you don't quite know as much about as you would like to. It's a growth experience. And you need to be willing to tackle new frameworks, and including a framework that would place less privilege on the Western experience. And then third, there is now really a pretty abundant literature in world history. You could start with books like Patrick Manning's Navigating World History. There are a number of basic introductions to the field, and there are all sorts of ways to develop a suitable working knowledge of some of the major societies, some of the major contact patterns. You know, it's an assignment, but it's not an impossible assignment in order to get going in developing this new course.
My guest today has been Peter Stearns, professor of history at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Peter Stearns, thanks so much for being with us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
For more historical thinking, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can comment on today's program and find show notes, links, and readings related to today's conversation. Historically Thinking is recorded in the studio of WAUG, the student radio station of Augustana College. Our program's editor is John Ruddat. Beth Leimbach keeps the schedules in sync. Matt Lejas keeps WAUG studio running. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.